Okay, everyone. Good to be back again. It's 8:31, so we're going to start part two of the classes on Shaul Lieberman. Just a few things. Well, first, I want to thank one of the listeners who sent me two nice pictures. I shared one a second ago, but I'll share it again in a second one. Let's see what happened. Here is one for those who just came online and not seen it. This is Shaul Lieberman, Hoshana Rabbah, as JTS 1971 in his talis. Here's another, I like these pictures very much. Here's another picture of him. Also Hoshana Rabbah. Notice you see between, on the left is Finkelstein, like a good Litvak, Finkelstein is wearing his tefillin. Why Lieberman as a Litvak? I guess probably because of his years in Eretz Yisrael, or maybe because of his connection to the Vilna Gaon. The Gra, the Vilna Gaon, was against wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. I've noticed, by the way, today, when I was growing up, it seems like half the people were wearing it. Now it's like you can hardly find someone who's wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. I think there's been a decline, and people used to stop wearing it. In Eretz Yisrael, the minhag is absolutely not to wear it. In the middle, between Finkelstein on the left, Lieberman on the right, you could see Heschel right there. In these pictures, Lieberman would be 71, so that's 73 years old. One other point I just want to make you about pictures is I showed you this picture last class. Now, I don't know how they do this. Maybe the people who know the science, the technical people can. I said I thought this was a picture with Finkelstein and Rosenthal, Lizer Shimshon Rosenthal. It turns out it's just with Finkelstein. But look what I'm going to show you now, because the picture also appears in the Spiro book. You see Lieberman, you're looking at the right side of his face, and you're seeing his right hand. Now, here's the actual picture. Oops, so let me stop sharing for a second. Here's the actual picture. You can see it. You're looking at now Lieberman with Finkelstein, but it's Lieberman's left side of his face and his left hand. I don't know how these things are turned inside out and are turned around, but that's what it is. Just a couple things before we begin the classes, because I still have these comments I want to get to from earlier classes. First of all, this is taking us back to class number 20. In my series last, Rabbi Weiss from the Village Shul in London, I had mentioned that there are two craters on the moon named after Jewish rabbis. One is Abraham Zakuto and the other is Levi Ben Gershom. And he writes to me that there's another crater, which I didn't even know about. Lo and behold, let's see, hold on a second here. Here it is, Aben Ezra. So those who are interested in astronomy, notice that it refers to Ibn Ezra here in Wikipedia as an astronomer and an astrologer. Unlike the Rabbah and Zakuto, I know nothing about Ibn Ezra as an astronomer. Unless you're going to say that in medieval times, an astrologer is an astronomer, but he was only interested in astrology. I want to show you another thing now. A few of you were very interested in Rabbi Yaakov Koppel Schwartz from last semester. You remember the Satmar rabbi with all sorts of interesting ideas, provocative ideas. Lo and behold, I'm at a wedding this week. And who's the Masada Kiddushin? None other than Rav Yaakov Koppel Schwartz. That's me with him. Don't ask about masks. I'm assuming they all had it. But I took my mask off, and here I am with Rav Yaakov Koppel Schwartz, and I met people from his shul. It was very, very nice. So with that having been said, let us pick up where we were last class. I noticed that a lot of people are interested in the topic. We have like 370 already watches on YouTube, which I think is interesting for what you could say is a bit of an arcane subject for some people. I do want to correct a mistake last week. I confused something. We were speaking about Shama Friedman and the Israel Prize. I said that first Shama Friedman won it, then Halivni won it. It's the opposite. Now I remembered. It was Halivni won it in 2008, and people were saying that it's not fair. Shama Friedman's been a citizen of Israel since the 70s, and Halivni had only recently, I guess, become one, and he certainly wasn't living in Israel at the time. But he won it in 2008, and then Chama Friedman won it in 2014. Anyone who's interested, you can read this article that appeared in Tablet 7 years ago, the year of the when he won it. All about Chama Friedman, his background, and Shai Secunda says as follows. He's also a big scholar, and he says that Chama Friedman is the most important Talmudist of his generation. And you can read all about it here on Tablet if you're interested in knowing about that. One of the things that Chama Friedman's students are doing is they're producing academic volumes of the Talmud. So here is just one. See how big this is, how thick this is? One chapter in Maseches Erevin. This is on one chapter, chapter 10. And it's a combination of critical, well, mostly an academic study. But he's really creating a revolution in Talmud study. We'll see how he his approach relates to Lieberman. Okay, let's return to the story we're telling, this fascinating story of Reb Shaul Lieberman. The last thing we did was I pointed out that I think I read to you the great rabbis he's related to. We also know that his family was comfortable, so we're told. Before Lieberman is bar mitzvah, he's sent to yeshiva in the city of Malch. It's called M-A-L-T-C-H. That's how it's usually spelled. Hold on a second. I get a few. Sorry, I'm here. Dropping all my stuff. Malch, it's not one of the most famous yeshivas, but it was near Motul, the city he's from. It's associated with Rav Shimon Shkup, if that name means anything to you. The great Rav Shimon Shkup, who together with Chaim Soloveitchik, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, pioneer of the so-called analytic method. Rav Shimon actually comes to America to raise money. And while in America, he becomes a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elkanan. He's only there 1 year. But in all the Wayu literature, when they speak with the great Rosh Yeshiva, they mention Rav Shimon Shkup as they should mention Rav Shimon Shkup. If you look in Rav Shimon Shkup's Chidushim, it says Rav Shimon Yehuda Shkup, but he spells Yehuda, Yud Aleph Vav Dalad. Aleph at the end, maybe even, but so as not to put the tetragrammaton. But he's obviously one of the great Rosh Yeshiva. He was called back to Europe. They say the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski said that his yeshiva was going to fall apart. So he leaves and he returns to Europe. But when he's also interesting because some years ago, there was an article in maybe Haaretz or one of these early papers. He had his granddaughter was, I believe she was Mapam, completely irreligious, member of Knesset. Her son was killed in the War of Independence, as I recall. But he had a very close correspondence and relationship with his granddaughter, who really represented in some ways, you know, the new Israel, the anti-religious Israel. That's Rav Shimon. We could talk a lot about Rav Shimon. Maybe we'll have questions on Rav Shimon. But when Lieberman came there, he wasn't Rosh Hashiva then. He had recently left around 1907, and he was not. Then he went to Grodno, but Lieberman comes in 1910. Prior to Lieberman, however, there was another great rabbi, so we know a lot about the yeshiva, Rav Unterman, Rav Isser Yehuda Unterman. We'll come back to Rav Unterman later because of his relationship to Lieberman. He started in Malch when he was 12 years old. So already you see that this is sort of like a yeshiva. We would call it a high school, I guess, a preparatory yeshiva. Even Baranovich, as we saw in our classes, Baranovich, the great Chanan Wasserman's yeshiva, that's a preparatory yeshiva. You would go there for a few years, and then you move on to the great yeshivas, Mir, Sabotka, Tells. There was also a yeshiva, actually, in Malch, as I recall, even before Rav Shimon. It was run Rav Zalman Sender Shapiro. We're told that Rav Zalman Sender, he had to leave Malch because he couldn't take it. Even the young people were infected with Zionism and Haskalah, and the yeshiva ceased to function. Rav Shimon comes, he establishes the yeshiva again. And he also, one of the reasons Rav Shimon leaves Malch is because of the same issues. This was the time of revolutionary feelings and all these things. You couldn't rely on the students to be faithful in many ways. So he leaves, Malch, and you could, by the way, you can read all about this in this book. very interesting book. It's called Yeshivat Lita Pirkei Zichronot, and it's memoirs of all, lots of memoirs devoted to the Yevoloshin Yeshiva, Telz Yeshiva, Sabuk Yeshiva, and then the smaller yeshivas, Malch, Lida. And they reprint Rav Unterman's essay here. Why did he write an essay on Malch? Because shortly before Rav Shimon dies, they published something in his honor. It was a way to raise money, which had never before appeared in traditional Jewish circles. And Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski has to have an introduction explaining why they're doing this. What am I referring to? A Sefer HaYovel. In the academic world, if you look in the Jewish academics, already from the mid-19th century, you have Jubilee volumes in German and Hebrew. Sefer HaYovel, though, that's not really traditional, but they did a Sefer HaYovel for Rav Shimon. Usually you do it with someone 70 years old, and subsequent to that, no one raises any thoughts about it. You can do a Sefer HaYovel. Rav Soloveitchik had a very, very nice Sefer HaYovel. So you can read about it there. So who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Rav of the city who reestablished the yeshiva? His name was Rav David Tevel Dinovsky. When Lieberman comes, he's the Rav of the city. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. I actually found a picture of him. Lo and behold, I found it from Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. Here he is. Rav David Tevel Dinovsky, Rabbah Shel Malch, and also the Rosh Yeshiva. Now, why is he in... why is he in Nassim Kamenetsky's book? Before Making of a Gadol, he had this Hebrew volume, which was sort of written by Yonason Rosenblum, but with all the assistance of Rav Nassim Kamenetsky, because Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky had also been there a few years. Yaakov Kamenetsky was older than Rav Shaul. He unfortunately is killed by the Nazis. There is actually an important letter from Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Cook that hasn't yet appeared in his collected letters, although it has appeared elsewhere. The reason it hasn't appeared in his collected letters, I have it here, is because they're going in order. Where is it? In order of years. They're up to about 1930, and this letter to Rabbi Dinovsky is from 1934. Rabbi Dinovsky wrote this book you're looking at, Likrat Samei. What does Sameh stand for? I guess thirsty, but it stands for Tzionim, Mizrachim, Orthodoxy. It's all about, it's an opposition to religious Zionism. And one of the famous points of Rav Cook that he responds in this letter is as follows. He writes to Rav Dinovsky, because Rav Dinovsky was concerned, I guess you could say, didn't understand the point that Rav Cook makes, that many people don't understand, that Rav Cook writes and all wrote that the Nefesh, Nefesh is, I guess, part of the soul, I guess you could determine as the Nefesh of the sinners is more exalted than the Nefesh of the righteous ones. But the righteous ones, their neshama, their ruach, I guess you could say, not neshama, their ruach is more advanced. So how could you say that the nefesh of an irreligious person is more advanced than the righteous ones? But so he explains the ruach of the tzaddikim. Rav Cook elaborates. This is found in the book Halichos Araya, volume 3, in which if you looked at the irreligious, they had a connection to the people of Israel, that is, as a nation, to the land. And he develops the idea that this is from the nefesh, whereas the tzaddikim, they're on a higher level, obviously, and the ruach is on a higher level. The nefesh is the lower level of the neshama. But still, this is Rav Cook's great dialectical understanding that even the poshei Yisrael, the sinners, they have something that's lacking in the righteous one. So really the best explanation, and he says it comes from Rav Chaim Vital, the best explanation of Rav Cook's whole theory about this, lo and behold, is found in this letter to Rabbi Dinovsky. Incidentally, at the beginning, he says that I'm not going to talk about your book, Likrat Sameh, because I don't want to get involved in these disputes. I guess you'd call them quasi-political disputes, because you can't decide them. How are you going to decide who's right? And then he says, "Ein b'hem hachara, we can't decide." And he says, "Those religious people who help, proto-Zionists, I guess you would call them, or Chovei Tzion types, they believe that even these irreligious people, they fulfill God's word, that God's plan to be His agents." But it's an important letter. So Lieberman, he goes to Malch. He studies there under Reb Donofsky. He wasn't there very long before. Reb Yaakov was not there very long. He goes to Slobodka, but Lieberman would follow him as well. We don't know, though, how long Lieberman was in Slobodka. Reb Yaakov was in Slobodka for around 3 years. We don't know Lieberman. And in fact, we don't know anything about Lieberman's time, or almost anything about Lieberman's time in Slobodka. As far as I know, he never recollects about it. He never mentions, most people went to Slobodka, would refer to the altar of Slobodka. You had Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein there, great Rosh Yeshiva. All we have, to my knowledge, is one piece, and it's not so nice, but I will share it with you. Recorded from people in the Ruderman family and the Shulman family. The Ruderman family is from Near Yisrael, and the Shulman family, the son-in-law, the wife of the son-in-law, the daughter, I should say, of Rav Yitzchak Sher, Rosh Yeshiva of Mashgiach of Slobodka Yeshiva. Where do I get what I'm going to tell you from? It's from this book, Making of a Godel, Nosson Kamenetsky's book. Supposedly, in the next issue of the Jewish Review of Books, I have an article coming out on Rav Nosson Kamenetsky, but I'm waiting for it for a while, so I don't know. I was asked to write it. In this book, on page 1190, Rabbi Ruderman is quoted as saying, well, let me get the exact, it's from Rav Shechter Neuberger, who was saying in the name of his uncle, that Rabbi Ruderman, who was 2 years younger than Lieberman, he was originally, they were supposed to be roommates, but it says that here, and this is from Rabbi Ruderman, that the altar of Sabotka moved Rabbi Ruderman out of Rabbi Lieberman, together with Lieberman, and put him in his own home until he's able to find a different room for him. Why? Lest he be detrimentally influenced by his older roommate. Listen, if this was just talk, I wouldn't take it seriously, but it comes from Rabbi Neuberger. It says it comes from Rabbi Ruderman. Apparently, the altar saw that Slobodka was not enough for Lieberman, that he had broader vistas. And he thought that Lieberman should not have a roommate. He wasn't thrown out of the yeshiva or anything, but the idea is that Lieberman should be there with it by himself, not with a roommate. However, then Kamenetsky goes on to quote Chaya Miriam Shulman, who I'm assuming is the wife of Rav Mordechai Shulman, who also becomes in Israel the Rosh Yeshiva Slobodka, the son-in-law of Yitzhak Sher. And she claims, I guess a family tradition, that when Lieberman went to the altar to say his goodbyes because he was going to Novartik, Rabbi Ruderman said that certainly he should leave Slobodka. Because from Sabatka, no one leaves Sabatka to become wayward. First, they have to go somewhere else. And Rabbi Ruderman is quoted as saying that he fooled the altar, who thought that Rav Shaul had come to learn here, but really he came to see what it was like. I'm not sure what that means, because he certainly did learn there. And then he quotes finally, Rabbi Ruderman is saying, and this is significant if it's true, that really Lieberman was expelled from Sabatka. Hard to imagine. He claims that Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein found an excuse to expel him when the altar was away. Likely because, because quote, he went someplace that the Rosh Yeshiva told him not to go, which they think is a cinema. I don't know if this is true, and it doesn't make sense with the other story, because if he expelled him when the altar was away, then how could he say goodbye to the altar? So I don't know. We will need to. I don't know if we'll ever know this. And these are the sorts of stories that Kamenetsky's book is full of. Really, X heard from Y, who heard from Z. The exact sort of thing that can't be determined if there's any truth to it. And but at least it's important that in the yeshiva world, this is the, they call it the hak. This is the gossip. that they would say about Lieberman. That Slabucka was too small for him, that he had broader vistas, that itself is not a criticism. Because as we will see, that Lieberman definitely did have broader vistas. Anyone with his ideas about how to study Talmud, even though this will only come later, but clearly the fact that he was willing to go to the Hebrew University showed that he was looking for something something broader. But let's leave it at that. I'm just telling you, I wasn't there, I can't say. So he goes to Navardic. How much time was he in Navardic? Navardic is, for someone like a Lieberman, might have been a strange place. He didn't recollect about it. Navardic was the most extreme of the Musa yeshivas. It still exists today, Navardic, but it's not like it used to be. Navardic, David Fishman of the seminary has written a classic article on Navardic. We have other good stuff on Navardic. Navardic was all, unlike Sabatka, Sabatka was what they call Gadol Sadam, to build you up. You're a creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, to build you up, that you have to live up to what this is. In Navardic, it was called Shiflas Adam, to push you down. And there's all sorts of stories about how, what they would do, the exercises they would do to uproot your ego. I guess it works for some people. Some people go to military academies when they do that. But they would do things in Navardic they didn't do elsewhere. First of all, they would have beards. They would wear tzitzis all to the ground. They'd wear dirty clothes. They'd confess their sins. That is unusual. Confessing sins? Since when do we do that in traditional Judaism? But they would confess to other people. So it's, and when we say Navardic, there was the main yeshiva in Navardic, and they opened up all sorts of branches. And don't think you couldn't be a great Talmudist coming on Navardic. The type were. Rabbi Kanievsky, Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, he went to Navardic. But Navardic, it was regarded as extreme Musar approach, very different than the altar of Slabodka. In the past, I've shown you pictures of what the people from Slabodka looked like. I mean, in their light suits, everyone dressed perfectly. In fact, it's been a long time since I showed you this, so let me just see if I can quickly pull it up. A great picture, so you get a sense. I think I just found it online. This one picture, yes, I'm going to show you here. It more than anything, it gives you a sense of what Slabodka was like. And so let's see. Here's a picture of these are Slabodka students in Israel, Chevron, when he went to Israel. But just look at that picture. This is Gadlus Adam. You dress, you see them right there. You see that they took pride in how they looked. And I think this is a book about Slabodka in Lita and also in Eretz Yisrael, from Lithuania and then to Hebron by Shlomo Tkachinsky. It hasn't been translated to English. It's a great book. The title of it is, you know, Learning and also Musar Elitism. So, and in the book, you see pictures. There's a, I did a little blog post on it. I'll show you what Rav Huttner looks like, also from Slabodka. This is, he died young, one of the sons of the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Moshe Finkel. You know who this is here? Anyone guess who this is on the right? Well, I'll tell you. That's Rabbi Huttner. The people, the way they dressed, the way they were, Slabodka was something. I knew someone when I was young who had gone to Slabodka in pre-war Europe. His name was Rechana Person. He survived the Kovno ghetto, and he had gone to Slabodka. I have a picture of him at my bar mitzvah. So we don't know how long Lieberman was in Navardic. He also studied in the Ukraine, a city. I'm not going to pronounce the name of it, but he both studied and even lived in the house for a bit, we're told, by Rav Shlomo Palachek. Rav Shlomo Palachek, the famous Mechitzer. We've spoken about the Mechitzer so many times. He comes to America. He's the first Rosh Yeshiva, a Yeshiva Shir Bitzel Hanan of world stature. Then he passes away very young because of a gum disease. And it's precisely because of that that Rabbi Revel needs a new Rosh Yeshiva. So he brings in Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. And then as long as Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is coming, J.B. Soloveitchik comes along also. And he gets a position in Boston and also later teaches at Yeshiva. But had Rav Moshe Soloveitchik remained in Warsaw where he was, had the Mechitzer not passed away, then you probably never would have seen Rav Soloveitchik in America, and unfortunately probably would have been killed. But Rav Shlomo Palachek, although a Talmud Mufak, leading student, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, was a Zionist, was very open-minded. You have just people today in Eretz Yisrael who are descendants of Roshoma Palachek, and the religious Zionist world. There's a street named after him. He's known as the Mechitzer Evil. He shows up and comes to Volozhin. He's like 12 years old, the youngest they ever had. In previous classes, we spoke about him. And Lieberman receives smicha, where Spiro and Shalcha tell us, when he was 18 years old. That would have been in 1916. And by 1919, he's already studying in the Kiev Gymnasium. So like so many others, he wants to broaden himself. He wants a secular education. So he's going to the gymnasium, where the gymnasium, you learn Russian, you learn mathematics, history, all the things you need to learn. But we know very, very little of his during all this period. It's unusual, because you think that other than the article, and I'll read you some more later, his article that he wrote about with the Chazon Ish in Minsk, we know very, very little. During this period, he also marries. He marries his first wife, his name Rachel. She's the daughter of the Rav of Minsk. His name is Eliezer Rabinowitz. He is, if you read books, I'll tell you he's one of the leading rabbis in Lithuania. And I think that is a correct statement in terms of, influence, whether this is a gadol. We'll get back to last week's class. He was an important person. He was an important person in Agudas Yisrael, but he wasn't one of the great outstanding Torah scholars when you think about who were the leading gadolim from the Torah scholar standpoint. He has a volume of response that only appeared in 1962. His father-in-law, however, was Rav Yochum Perlman. He's known as the Gadol of Minsk, the author of the Sefer, the Or Gadol. He is a Gadol Shebigdolim. So clearly, again, that Lieberman, he comes from Yichus, and he's marrying into Yichus. I can just tell you one story about his father-in-law, though, Rabbi Rabinowitz. When the Bolsheviks took over, they put the Navardic students in prison. And the local community would have to deliver, Minsk would deliver food to them, kosher food. Rabbi Rabinowitz Poskind, you can wrap the food, or you should, perhaps, he said. I can't remember if he said you can or you should. Probably you should. Wrap the food that you bring them, rip out pages from Gemara, wrap the food in, and bring it to them, because that will give the... And don't worry that the pages, you know, Torah pages are going to be ruined by that, because this will give them a chance to study Torah. At least now they're being held by the Bolsheviks, or probably it was probably the Jewish Bolsheviks. He thought that this the chance to learn Gemara, learn Torah, rises. It's have a higher level than the concern of treating Torah pages with respect. I mentioned in previous classes in Alivni's memoir, he speaks about how during the Holocaust in Auschwitz, somehow they had one page of the Torah. Existed. Someone had it, and they would pass that around, and they treated it. It was so precious that in the middle of Auschwitz, there was actually a holy page. This family of the children, I should say, the daughters of Rabbi Rabinowitz, they all married other interesting people. Another daughter of Rabinowitz married Rav Joseph Shub, not one of the Gedolei Yisrael, but he was the right hand man of Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. He was like what we call today the Askan, but he was the secretary, basically, of Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. He was killed in the war. And the third son-in-law, his name was Menachem Mendel Gluskin. He was the rabbi of Leningrad under the Soviets. He dies in 1936. So interesting family. We don't know much, though, about this wife, Rachel. She dies in 1930. As a very young woman. We don't know her ailment. If you look in Shochet and Spiro, they give different stories of why she died, including one that she died during pregnancy. But there's also stories that they were already in Israel at this time, Eretz Yisrael, that Lieberman was so poor he couldn't afford medicine. And that's all sometimes said as explaining why he thought it was important to get a steady position. We don't know. And if she died in pregnancy or something like that, it wouldn't have been because of that. He remarries 2 years later. He remarries a very special woman, very interesting woman, the daughter of Rav Meir Berlin, or he becomes known as Meir Bar Ilan, the head of the Mizrahi movement. Her name is Judith Berlin, and I have a good picture of them together. Here they are. This is a young picture. So this would have been about Lieberman, who's about 32, 33. So that's Judith Lieberman on the left, Reb Shaul, young Reb Shaul on the right. She was a personality in her own right. You can read about her online, for instance, the Jewish Women, Encyclopedia of Jewish Women. You have a whole article on Judith Lieberman and her career. She was very involved in Mizrahi women and other things. She even wrote a book. She went to, where does it say here? I forget now. Yeah, she had a PhD in comparative literature from Zurich. She published it here, a small book. These European dissertations are always small. They're not very long, maybe more like a master's. But Robert Browning and Hebraism, a study of the poems of Robert Browning based on the rabbinical writings. Lieberman had such respect for her. You have to see, he mentions her in the introduction to Sefta Kivshuta. She also would become the principal of the Hebrew principal of the Shulamis school, which today you have two. You have one in Brooklyn and one in Long Island, a separate branch. But here is the Shulamis school, which, I mean, you can read all about, for example, the history of the Shulamis school. They'll tell you 85 years, founded in 1930. So it's more than 80. They got to, if it's founded in 1830, they got to fix it now 90 years or more. And then it mentions here, they're not ashamed of this at all. From 1941, Dr. Judith Lieberman served as the Hebrew principal. But what I find fascinating is if you go down, what are they? They say the first all-girls yeshiva in North America. I love the fact that they call it a yeshiva. Why do I love that they call it a yeshiva? Because when I had my year in Israel, where the girls went to school, they called it a girls yeshiva. My daughters, who all have been to school, what do they call it? They call it a seminary. I don't. What does seminary mean? Seminary is if you're training to be a rabbi or training to be a teacher or something. These girls are not trained to be anything; just going to study. So I don't know. In my time, you can call it a girls' yeshiva, but and here you have Shulamis, which is more right wing than the modern Orthodox schools I've showed you videos of before, and yet they call it a girls' yeshiva, which. It also says, hold on a second, I want to see something else here. I've showed you some other schools. I just was curious. Yeah, so Maya Note also. Maya Note calls it, I'm looking online now, Yeshiva High School for Girls. So very good. But what I wanted to show you also is here. It is the only religious Zionist girls' school in Brooklyn. That's also a big deal. Because there's lots and lots of schools in Brooklyn. you can hardly walk down the street without seeing a school. But if you're from the older generation, if you're a dinosaur in Brooklyn, that is, you still believe in Zionism. You believe that Yom HaTzmut, you shouldn't say Tachlin, and maybe Rachman HaTzmut, you should even say Hallel without a bracha or something. You got that one shul there, right? Bethel, I guess it is. And you got a school, though, there. You can send your girls to that school. There isn't a boys' school that's religious Zionist. That you'd have to go. Well, that's not true. You go to Flatbush, but if you're so take that back. But there's no all boys' school, as far as I know. Correct me if I'm wrong. So that's the Shulamis school. Now, her picture, if you look in Spiro, and I knew this, by the way, before I saw it in Spiro, because I was very friendly, still am, with someone who was very involved in Shulamis. But on page 14, it says, after Judith Lieberman's death in 1978, the Shulamis school commissioned her portrait. It was presented to Saul Lieberman at the school's annual dinner in 1979 and was then hung in the principal's office. Rabbi Moshe Zwick, executive director of Shulamis, assured Lieberman that the portrait would remain there for as long as Rabbi Zwick remained with the school. Now, I know that I don't know when Rabbi Zwick left the school, but as of 15 years ago, the portrait was still hanging in Shulamis. I can't tell you if it is today. I don't know. But if anyone sends their kids there, you could tell me if her portrait is still there. I have another picture somewhere here of Judith Lieberman, an older picture. I can't. Yes. You can't really see it that well. It's from, if you look up, it's from the Encyclopedia of Chalutzei HaYishuv, Encyclopedia of people involved in building up Eretz Yisrael. She had a sister we spoke about already. Actually, no, we didn't speak about it. I spoke about Rachel Margolios as a learned Jewish woman. One of her sisters was, I don't know how many sisters, was married to Abraham Halkin, who also taught the seminary, great Hebraist, the father of Hillel Halkin. I'm sure people know Hillel Halkin, or Philologus, as he's known in the foreword. Hillel Halkin, by the way, has a, since I showed you the picture before of Lieberman with a talus, he records the following from Lieberman, which was said, I don't know if it was said seriously or half in jest, but Lieberman told him, that's his uncle, one day, he doesn't know why he has to daven. He says, God knows everything I need. And also, it's Bittul Torah. Spend all this time davening, it could be learning. But then Hillel Halkin records that on the Yom Noraim, I guess Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I don't know which one, he saw Lieberman with the talus over his head crying. So it's a typical Litvisha thing, you know, that what's more important. Obviously, we've spoken about this already numerous times. Learning is more important, but he also could be very emotional on it. Lieberman, who at the end of his life had significant amount of money. In 73, he gave a lot of his money to Israel, the state of Israel, very happily. But after his wife dies, he endows, where is it? There's an educational institution called, or educational village, whatever they call it, Ramot Shapiro. Lieberman gave the money to open up this institute, Machon Lieberman. I don't know what its original purpose was. But hold on a second. Is it? So you can read all about Ramot Shapiro, Merkaz Chinuchi. But now you can see they deal, I guess, with psychology, family counseling. From a religious standpoint, you can see the teachers there or the instructors. So this is, I was shocked, however, I went everywhere on the website here and I can't see where, anywhere you go concerning. So you want to read about Machon Lieberman and it tells you what they are, what they do outside of Jerusalem. But I was unable to find anywhere where it actually explains why it's called Machon Lieberman. Some people might think it's after Shaul Lieberman or just after any other Lieberman. As far, I can't see anywhere where it explains that, which it should, being that, you know, there's a focus, as you can see there, on women in that whole, I don't know if it's only women, but it's definitely there. From the pictures I showed you, you see a lot of women involved there. You'd think that they would want to tell people that this is named after a great religious Zionist woman, Judith Bar Ilan Lieberman. So, I can't find it, and I do believe it's a lacuna there. Getting back to original and Lieberman, his first marriage. So how do you make a living? Normally, Yeshiva Bachrim, they become Rabbanim or something like that, or supported by their father-in-law. If you look in Shochet and Sphero on page 7, it tells us that for several months he lived in the Rabinowitz home. Then he went to Kiev to work. He worked in the carbon paper business. He went into business with two of his uncles who were involved with coins, making coins, minting gold coins for old, new coins, for old coins. He was just trying to make a living. And then he decided to move to Israel. Not really... not doing so well financially. He had been interested in medicine, however. And after going in 1927 to Eretz Yisrael, he returns to Europe, goes to Paris to study medicine at the Sorbonne. And I believe it was Sorbonne. Yes, pretty sure it was the Sorbonne. But that only lasts even less than a year, because in 1928, he's back in the land of Israel, where at the age of 30, he enrolls in the Hebrew University. He taught in religious school, high school, and then he enrolls in the Hebrew University. I don't know what he was doing for money at the time then, because his wife passes away in 1930. Because if he's in Hebrew University, maybe he's also teaching on the side. He didn't live very well, let's put it that way. So what's so significant about enrolling in Hebrew University? Because he meets someone who's going to have a big impact on his life. And that's, let me show you a picture of him. His name is Yaakov Nachum Epstein. He's usually referred to as Maharin Epstein. He's given that title. He's born in Brisk. Professor, you know, obviously a big Torah scholar before he also does the academic route. And he becomes professor of Talmud at Hebrew University. You will see that Lieberman and him have a bit of a break. We'll talk about that later. And he begins to study. For the first time, Lieberman is exposed to an academic approach to Torah study. Yaakov Nachum Epstein, he writes classic introduction to the Mishnah. He was a scholar's scholar. And Lieberman is very loyal to him. I'll read you in a little bit what Lieberman says about him in response to the Chazon Ish. But I just want to read you from the Lieberman Memorial Volume. There's an article by Chaim Zalman Dimitrovsky and another one of these, from Shraga Abramson, another one of these Talmidei Chachamim who makes his way to the seminary. And he says as follows. It's on page 26 and on. He talks about how Epstein was the first one to expose Lieberman to what does it mean, critical study, to the sources of the Tanaim, to the different dialects, the different phraseology they're using. And he talks about how, you know, the idea of an Eloi of Eloi's, but... nevertheless, he knew nothing about academic studies. He knew nothing about the German Torah scholar, the German academic scholars. So this was a completely new world for him. In fact, Halivni says as follows, and this is quoted by Shochan and Spiro on page 8. They say that when he arrived at Hebrew University, he didn't know even the names of the great Jewish Western Jewish academicians, including Zachariah Frankel. Who's Zachariah Frankel? Only perhaps the greatest of the academic scholars of the 19th century in terms of study of Talmud. He wrote, Yerushalmi, I should say, he wrote three volumes, Zachariah Frankel, on the Jerusalem Talmud. Here's one of them. Believe it or not, it's on HebrewBooks.org, two of the volumes. On Brachos, on Peah, and on Demai, it's if you look, for instance, the pages, it's done. It's like a Tosfos, and also like in Rashi, and that's Zachariah Frankel. And Zachariah Frankel was a real Lamdin, also an Eloi. But Lieberman had never heard of him. And the questions, we're going to see some of these questions. The questions, though, that in the academic world they ask. See, in the traditional world, the study of Talmud is limited to the way the text you're doing. And other volumes of the Talmud to maybe explain what you're doing here. You never ask a question, for instance, in a traditional study. Well, who says that this answer that the Emorah is giving is correct? And what about if we've seen the Tosefta, they have a completely different approach to this. Maybe had the Emorah known what the Tosefta records, then there wouldn't be a problem. And if you look at the Yerushalmi, you see the Yerushalmi doesn't have a problem because the Yerushalmi assumes that Yerushalmi has certain knowledge that they didn't have, and as well as obviously questions of philology. You see words that don't look Hebrew. What does this word mean? It looks like a Greek word. So fine, you look up the Aruch. But the Aruch is 1,000 years old. A lot has happened since the days of the Aruch. And both from a philological standpoint and also from a critical standpoint in terms of the knowledge in front of you. Today, you have lower criticism. Today, of course, they even deal with higher criticism. We'll get into all this in a little bit. Lieberman is only there. He enrolls at the age of 30. It's 1928. By 1929, Lieberman has published his first book. Obviously an Eloi. What did he publish? And this is the person who didn't know who Zachariah Frankel was just the year before. Within a year, he publishes, where is it? I think I have it here somewhere. Ah, here it is. Look at this. He publishes a little book, Al HaYerushalmi. What is the point of this book? Well, first of all, he tells you to correct the text of the Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi wasn't studied that much. So there's a lot of textual corruptions in it. How do you correct the text? We'll talk about it in a minute. Two, he's using a different, he has a manuscript of Ketav Yad Rome to help illuminate Masach HaSota, and also he has notes and introductions, etc. This is his first book, Aliyah Yerushalmi, at the age of 31. Now he, if you look in this book, in the Aliyah Yerushalmi, he's 31 years old. He's only been studying in the academic world for a year. Lo and behold, he takes on Frankel. On page 47, he begins. He's respectful. He calls him a friend of Frankel, Zichron of Racha. Frankel wrote a book, a whole book, which he wrote towards the end of his life. Like he was only 7 years old or something, called Mavo Yerushalmi, an introduction. Lieberman takes on Frankel. And he says that Frankel, in his introduction, he only gives some of the terminologies, the special terminology Yerushalmi, and forgets and ignores or forgets many others. And then he says, what did Frankel? Nichshav harbe mekomot. Al yidei yidiyat signon Yerushalmi, that Frankel makes mistakes, a lot of mistakes, because he doesn't recognize the special signon, the style of the Jerusalem Talmud. This is the expert in Yerushalmi, Frankel. He wrote the introduction to the Yerushalmi. He wrote commentary in three volumes. And here, Lieberman has big shoulders. He's saying that Frankel doesn't understand these points, and he's going to give examples of this, and he gives a number of examples of this. I mean, you have to see what Lieberman does. He takes these words in the Yerushalmi that don't make so much sense, and you look at the commentaries, they try to come up with answers. What does it mean? And he amends the text. He says, no. Instead of the word, say, kaf hey yud, it should be kaf tut yud, and that's means a special, he shows how the Yerushalmi has a special way of using this word because it appears in one place and all the other places the word appears. The copyist didn't understand what it meant, so they changed it. He is able, when I say it's brilliant philology, it's the sort of thing that only will interest people who are, you know, maybe 10 people in the world, but he is able to show how so many words in the Jerusalem Talmud have been corrupted because the copyist didn't know what the word was. And then the commentaries don't know what to make of it, and they come up with all sorts of theories. But once, and sometimes these words are Greek words, and they've been corrupted. But when you put the Greek back in, then everything makes perfect sense. Such a person needs to be an expert in Greek, and an expert in Latin, an expert in the Talmud. I have an example of this, but I think it'll be too complicated to go into it now. Let me just say, how did he become expert in so short a time? He was all, because he's an Eloi. He knew the Yerushalmi. He knew it. He knew the Bavli. But he didn't know it, though, in an academic sense. So once he was exposed to the academy, well, then everything fit in. And then it started making sense. He already had the knowledge. He just needed the approach. And that's what Epstein gave him. The fact that he knew Yerushalmi is significant, because who learned Yerushalmi in traditional Lithuanian yeshivas? Even today, who learns Yerushalmi? I've said it before, that if you tell people that we found, like at Dead Sea Scrolls, we found, let's say, scrolls with writings from the Tanaim, people would go crazy. You'd have articles. Everyone would want to see it. Everyone would want to study it. We got something from the Tanaim. And I've said before, what's the big deal? We have writings from the Tanaim. We have the Tosefta. Who reads the Tosefta? We have all this writings from the Tanaim. We don't need it. First, let the people study the writings that we have. So, as I said, so Lieberman, an unbelievable Eloi. There's a rabbi. He should know better. He's got to be about 75 years old. He knew a little bit about Lieberman. I was at a show once. He said to me, did Lieberman know Bavli also or only Yerushalmi? I mean, the man knew Bavli by heart, Yerushalmi. So what did Lieberman do when Aliyah Yerushalmi appears? He sends a copy, of course, to his cousin, the Chazon Ish. How could he not send it to the Chazon Ish? And from the Chazon Ish's reply to Lieberman, we see that the Chazon Ish was not pleased. Now, we do not have the Chazon Ish's letter, but we have Lieberman's letter to the Chazon Ish in response, so we could see what the Chazon Ish's problem was with Lieberman. Without getting into this is found in Shmuel Gluck and Menachem Katz. They wrote an article about concerning Lieberman and his relationship with the Chazon Ish and Yaakov Nachum Epstein. First of all, there's the Talmudic discussion. The Chazon Ish had criticized Lieberman, and Lieberman defended a Talmudic reading. We're not going to go into that. That's most of the letter. But then at the end, Lieberman says, that which you, the Chazon Ish, said that I called Epstein Marie. I called Marie Verabi, Rachel Nechamesha, Marie. If you look, he always refers to Epstein in the early writings as Marie Verabi, my master, my teacher. And clearly the Chazon Ish wrote to him saying, how could you call Epstein such a title? That's the title, Marie Verabi, you refer to a Rosh Yeshiva, your Rebbe. You don't call an academic person. By the way, Epstein is going to be like Lieberman in the sense that Epstein in Berlin, although he's completely religious, his family, you know, are leading members of the religious Zionist world. He taught in Berlin at the Reform Rabbinical School, as well as other people we'll see, Orthodox Jews taught at the Reform Rabbinical School. Later, when we deal with women's ordination, we'll see that this first comes up in Berlin at the Rabbinical School of the Reform in Berlin, and we'll see what the Orthodox rabbi had to say about that. But so Epstein had taught in Berlin at the Reform. You had three big rabbinical schools. You had the Orthodox in Berlin, you had the Reform in Berlin, Geiger originally taught there, and then you have in Breslau, Frankl's institution, which people identify with conservative. So the Chazon Ish writes to Lieberman, had you referred to an academic scholar as Marie Verabi? Lieberman writes to him, I don't understand what you're saying. Rabbi, why can't I call him Marie Verabi? I learned from him, and I think kama should be translated here, a number of things. He's a completely religious Jew. Ma'amin. He's a believer. Medakdek b'mitzvot. Ve'eno lomei Torah l'shem chachma. He's saying that he's not still learning Torah as an academic pursuit. You had the irreligious people who were scholars. We've always had that. But for them, a Torah study, they could write a book on the Talmud, but they could also write a book on Herod's rule or on Homer's. It's just another subject for them. No, he's saying that for him, Torah study, although he's working in the academy, Torah study is Torah study. It's not an academic pursuit. V'ha-Torah shalamadati, he says mimena, it should be mimenu, the Torah that I learned from him, he Torah amitit v'lod derech maskilim. He says the Torah I've learned from Epstein isn't Haskalah Torah, academic type Torah, it's real Torah. And it's the method of the Rabboseinu, of the sages, who search the truth in Divrei Chazal. If Epstein can show you that we've been misunderstanding this Gemara because we don't know what this word means, it's really a Greek word, and now that we understand it, we can understand much better what the sugya is. How is that Lieberman saying? How is that not Torah? We're trying to figure out what Chazal were saying, what the Mishnah meant, what the Amorai meant. He says, with all the methods, he says, in a number of places that are unclear in Yerushalmi, it's been explained to me just through this method. And that's Al Yerushalmi. It's page after page of taking text in the Yerushalmi, and where he's able to show that there's a mistake in the text, or there's a parallel text in Yerushalmi that shows you how it should be understood. All these matters. And he gives some examples from that. He says, if I made mistakes on certain things, well, fine, but I've learned this from Epstein. And then he says, the Chazon Ish said to him that, let me just read you what Lieberman says in reply to the Chazon Ish, and you can see what the Chazon Ish said to him. That which you said, she'ein ani amel b'Torah, Hogan. He said that I'm not really focused on Torah the way I should be. The Chazon Ish must have said to him, why aren't you in the yeshiva? Only in the yeshiva can you really learn Torah. Here you're at the university. That's not really learning Torah. Lieberman says, Zefshar, it's possible that I'm not learning Torah properly. But he says, but there ani lifamim sometimes nofel al safsal mechoser onim merovit amtsut. He says, sometimes after learning so much, I have no more strength. I simply fall down. V'yoshev ani lifamim kamayimim al sugyacha im rosh chavush. I sit there with a headache for a few days just on one sugya. And he says, Adarabba, you should request to be rachamim of Hashem, that God should open my eyes. If my actions are not proper, certainly my intentions are proper. What he's replying to the Chazon Ish is that don't think that because now I'm doing an academic approach, then this way, this is at all opposed to Torah study. No, this is just an expansion of what Torah study should be. Of course, traditional Torah study is important and vital. And Lieberman would always remain part. If you look into his writings, this is not a replacement. This isn't like Shama Friedman or Halivni replacing the traditional approach with a new approach. No, this is the traditional approach, just widening it. That is, we're not dealing with higher criticism. We're looking at pshat. What does the text mean? Well, if I can show you what the text means because we have a manuscript, or I can show you what the text means because of a Greek word, or I can show you what the text means because I know that there's this one Yerushalmi passage, and we see that they use this abbreviation, so now I show you a word, and what if this word should be replaced with an abbreviation. But the copyist didn't understand it, so he gave it, offered, put another word in. That's pshat. And that's what Lieberman is. Lieberman is not about any grand theories. He's never going to be about that. He's page after page, sugya after sugya, the pshat. He's like a Rashi. Lieberman is like Rashi, trying to explain to you what the text means. And he can't understand why the Chazon Ish sees this as taking away from Torah. In the German Orthodox approach, on the contrary, this would be adding to Torah. The more information we have, the more it helps us understand it. And that's going to be really the path of Lieberman. I see it's already late, so I'll stop here. We're going to continue next class. Wait to hear what he tells Lieberman with Ginsberg, and give some more examples of him and his connection to the Yerushalmi. And then he gets a job. And we'll see, this will lead us into the relationship with Rav Kook, his job, the Harry Fischel Institute. Well, Harry Fischel. This is such an interesting figure. We are, as I said, we still have a lot to do, but I see it's already 8:27. So let me take the quest, 9:27. Let me take the questions and comment on it. Susanna Nono, that is JTS. Not only it's both in the same place. And wait, I'm holding off because there's another picture of Hoshanas. Them marching, and wait till you see who's marching. And that's going to be, when we get to the issue of the machitza, or lack of it, at the seminary, you will see a picture, and we'll talk about Lieberman's view about in the Unterberg Auditorium. Does that even exist anymore, the Unterberg Auditorium? I don't know if it exists anymore, but that's the picture where it takes place. Baruch says that Finkelstein was not just a good witvak. He had an atar on his talus. Okay. Well, his father was a real Rav and Talmud Chacham, and he raised Finkelstein. So, no, he was a Finkelstein. Finkelstein, towards the end of his time at the seminary, he thought it was such a big deal. He bought everyone time clocks on Shabbos so they could use. Finkelstein was 100% Shomer Torah and Mitzvahs. He was a rabbi of an Orthodox shul. At first, towards the end of his life, like everything else, the seminary moves left, and there was a minyan for many, many years in Finkelstein's apartment. He lived very old. He had what we call a Richos Yamim. And that minyan, after he passed away, it then moved to the Upper West Side. They called it Orach Eliezer, because Finkelstein is Eliezer. Finkelstein is Eliezer Finkelstein. And Halivni actually became the Mara D'Asra of that minyan. It was a completely Orthodox minyan, and I used to go to it on the Upper West Side, and it's the only time that Halivni functioned as a Mara D'Asra. And the shul exists in some sort of transformation in Riverdale, I believe, Dina Nyman, Rosh Kehila, but it was a very popular minyan. It was in, they rented space in the... There was a youth hostel, like 103rd in Amsterdam. But when I lived on the Upper West Side, I was there. But it was, as I said, it was a completely Orthodox minyan. Yeah, so it's a reversal. Alan says a reversal of the negative. Yeah, but I don't understand. It's interesting how those come out. And I'm told privately, someone says there's a great book by Rabbi Hamburger about the Shorshei Minhag Ashkenaz, about Minhag Ashkenaz. And volume 5 has 800 pages about Tefillin and Chol HaMoed, and also about the Zohar becoming popular. There's a lot to say. I believe that the Ashkenazic Rishonim do hold you wear Tefillin, but the Vilna Gaon says not. And the wedding of one of the Williamsburg Hasidim, actually it's Borough Park this time, but it's... Rabbi Barry Hartman says, I work with Rav Dovid Lifshitz and the Rav and Rav Dovid Shia. We regularly study the Shari Yosher Sefer of Shimon Shkath. He was very close to his granddaughter, who whenever she came to Grodno was respectful to her grandfather. Yes, this is, I forget her name now, the communist. And look, her son died defending the state, or was it pre-state maybe, I forget now. And Rabbi Shudnow says that Rabbi Kamenetsky was his Iyun Gemara teacher at branch of Itri with Rabbi Rabin. Someone asked me which branch of Navardic he went to. I'm not sure. I think it was the main one, but it was in exile. Baruch says confession is part of Judaism. I don't know, Baruch. Confessing to other people, confessing our sins publicly out loud in front of other people, that's not the Judaism I know. Sounds more like Catholicism. We confess our sins to God. In fact, the Sfarim say that you're not supposed to, on Yom Kippur, be too loud because someone will overhear you and you don't want it to overhear you. But they would have sessions in Navardic where they'd come together and it's a sense of shame. It brings shame upon yourself. They were all about getting rid of the ego. The famous story, which I don't know if it ever happened, but that they would say they'd go into a pharmacy and ask for nails. Today, pharmacy CVS might have nails, but an old-time pharmacy where all they have are drugs to ask for nails. I guess it's like, you call up your local pizza shop and ask, can I make a reservation or something? You know, just to do something where the guys will look at you and say, what kind of stupid thing are you saying to me? They would walk around with clothes that was dirty. And they were once challenged, supposedly, the founder of it, Rav Yozel. The Rambam says a Talmud Chacham who has a stain on his garment is Chayav Misa. So the response was, well, yes, but that's if you have a white shirt and then you have a stain, but our shirts have lots of stains. So we don't fall into that category. Baruch says, hard to accept it's the only Zionist girls' school in Brooklyn. Baruch, you live in Brooklyn. Let me know if there's another one. I don't know. They claim that it's the only Zionist girls' school in Brooklyn, and you have to go to Bergen County if you want the other Zionist schools. Let me know if there's another one. I don't know of any other ones because you go to the Israeli Day Parade other than Shalamis. What are the schools marching from Brooklyn? Other than Flatbush, but that's not a girls' school. That's co-ed. And then you have the Sephardim, the Syrian schools. It could be that are there any Syrian schools that are, usually the separate sex schools, they're more on the right, so it's hard to regard them as Zionists. Hey, when I went to JEC, Rabbi Teitz Yeshiva, we were not allowed to go to the Israeli Day Parade as a school. And I asked Rabbi Teitz Sr., Rav Pinchas Teitz, also from was in Slobodka. I asked him, how come we can't go to the Israeli Day Parade? And he said, we're a yeshiva. We're not like those Talmud Torahs. That's what he said. The JC today does go and march in the parade. I think what he meant by that is that, without saying it, is that yeshivas don't do things like that. They're not so Zionistic. M.N.S. Frankel says, the Matrix's grandson, also named Shalom, graduated from Columbia 68, then attended Hawaii for Smicha, even though he never previously attended Yeshiva. Family name provided sufficient protection for acceptance. He later made Aliyah, who and his wife was in the first Princeton class, to admit women. Yeah, we've spoken a lot in previous classes in Matrix, so I don't want to just repeat it, because many of you have been with me for so long. Very, very important figure. Someone privately mentions the Sefer from Rokeach, where he discusses confession to one's Rav, not necessarily Hashem. The Hasidei Ashkenaz also had interesting, unusual things. So you can find all sorts of interesting stuff among the Hasidei Ashkenaz, has never been mainstream. That's why they were unusual. That's all. It doesn't mean you can't find sources, we're talking about mainstream, typical, the way most people would do it. What you would have, obviously, is you'd have people, not in the sense of confession, but if they sinned, they would ask the rabbi what penance to do. That's different than like reciting your sins out loud, that sort of thing. Shlomo, yeah, the major tour is a Shlomo Palachek. So Mel says, I didn't know that Or Yerushalayim is in Ramot Shapiro, no relation to me. Nachum Epstein does not wear a yarmulke. It's hard to know in that picture. In Germany, he wouldn't have wore a kippah, other than when he was teaching or in shul. They didn't do that generally. In the picture, which is older, he's from Eretz Yisrael. That might have been a picture outside of. I find it hard to believe that when he's teaching, he wouldn't wear a yarmulke. I'm assuming there's no little one in the back. But generally, I can show you pictures of a lot of these German Orthodox types, and they don't have kippahs on, because unless they were in davening or in shul or in yeshiva, just a general picture, they wouldn't wear it. I have a picture, I mentioned this before, in Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, they were very religious at a wedding outside, where all the women are in shadels, because as I said before, the Hirschian community in Frankfurt wore shadels, the women, but the men are all bareheaded. And so you can't... We've spoken in the past. There's a picture of, well, this, you go on YouTube, not YouTube, you go on, you can Google this and see this, that Rabbi Nebenzahl's father, who's a very important person in the Israeli government, he was on the Agronaut Commission. You could see the early pictures, even on the Agronaut Commission, as I recall. He's not wearing a yarmulke. Yaakov Herzog, he has pictures in the state of Israel not wearing a yarmulke. It was thought, it's crazy when we think of this now, but these religious Jews thought that when they were working for these labor, irreligious figures, it's like they're working in America or Canada or something, and they felt that they actually had to take off their yarmulke, and they were in part of government. Well, today it's unimaginable, obviously, but it gives you a sense of what it was like to be a religious Jew in let's say, the late 40s, early 50s, even the 60s in the state of Israel. Rabbi Shudnow says that the Liebermans told us in 73, when he made a huge donation to Israel, that Israel was at the point of, God forbid, destruction. What would you say to your descendants if you didn't do everything to save Israel? Yes, he gave a lot of money. At his death, by the way, in his will, he also gave a lot of money to Chabad, which is of interest. Maybe we'll get back to that later. Can I give some examples of the Greek words? Yes. Well, we will, when we deal with, he has a whole book called Greek and Jewish Palestine, another one, Hellenism and Jewish Palestine. I'll try to give you some examples of that. Barry, did Rabbi Epstein from Brisk have any connection with Chaim Soloveitchik? He indeed did, Yaakov Nachum Epstein. I don't know if he ever had smicha, incidentally. Although, because in smicha, you could stay all these years in Lithuanian yeshiva, you could stay there 10 years. And if you're not going to take a rabbonis, you're not going to get smicha. You learn for 10 years, and then you go off and you become a businessman. You could be an unbelievable lamdan, but you don't have, quote, smicha. So I don't believe he had smicha. But he, not only did he know Reb Chaim, he came with a letter of recommendation from Reb Chaim Brisker to Reb Chaim Moser Grzynski to study in Reb Chaim Moser's kibbutz, his group of Torah scholars that he led in Vilna, and he didn't get in, even with the Reb Chaim Brisker's either, it's not clear why he didn't get in, but maybe already then, because we know he was going to Vilna also, he wanted to go to spend time in the library, the Strassen Library. So maybe at the Farheret, the interview with Reb Chaim Moser, he made the mistake of telling him that in addition to learning in Reb Chaim Moser's kibbutz, which had all sorts of great people in it, Rav Amiel and others, he might have said to him, I also want to spend time in the Strassen Library. And that maybe Reb Chaim Moser said, well, then you're not for me. But the fact that Reb Chaim writes him a letter of approbation. How do I know all this? Because Yaakov Nachum Epstein's granddaughter wrote a memoir, about 100 pages, on her grandfather. And she has an appendix there, and she includes the letters, two letters. Reb Chaim wrote him two separate times letters. And he talks about that he's a young Talmud Chacham, etc. And David Eisen tells us that Epstein's grandson is the Rav Yaakov Epstein, the author of Chavah Nachal Aso, a major religious Zionist posse. He comes out with a volume every single year. We quoted this, if you remember, two classes ago, the one dealing with the vegan restaurants, where I told you that in response to Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport and, he didn't write the tshuva, it's Fixler, Professor Fixler. Rav Yaakov Nachum Epstein has a whole tshuva in response to this about the vegan restaurants. Gershon Heppner says, Eino lo me mitoch chochma. Well, no. The language he used is that he says about him. I'll read you the exact words. He says, Torah amitit v'lo derech maskilim, ela hi derech rabosenu zal, shemachap simet ha'emes, the Divrei Chazal. So that's the language. So what does that mean, the Derech Maskili? The Derech Maskili is, I think what it means is higher criticism. If you look in Geiger and many others, they were interested in, they weren't looking at Pshat. They were trying to look in a much broader way, trying to show that certain sugyas are problematic because the author of the sugya, the Savarayim, the Stam, whatever you want to call it, even the Amorayim didn't have all the facts, and they're trying to recreate it. That's, you find that in Alivni, Feldblum, that, but that's what you already have Geiger doing. I think that's what he means. But Epstein was not doing that. They're interested in Pshat. Catherine says, if anyone has a photo of Herbert Dandy, the Anglican priest Liebman collaborated with, would be great to see. Well, you can, I've seen photos. I'll pull it up right now. I'm sure if I Google it, you'll get it. But you say, Herbert Danby was a canon. When I look for images, I don't get an image of him. I've seen an image. I just get of his books. Herbert Danby was in Jerusalem, the Anglican canon, and he translated the Mishnah. He also translated one of the volumes of the Mishnah Torah, the Yale Judaica series. But in terms of collaboration, you're going to have to tell me what they collaborated on, because I don't know of any collaboration. I thought Unterberg is a big auditorium. I've asked two rabbis, conservative rabbis, the picture I'm going to show you later, and they think that isn't Unterberg. Israel says, why do so few people know about Rabbi Lieberman? Do you have to meet him, like a standard Rav would have, that spread his name or create popular works? Well, first of all, you might be asking from the yeshivish world. I don't know. In the yeshivish world, they wouldn't know him because he's not part of that world. In the non-yeshivish world, I think among the religious academics, everyone knows him. In the conservative world, there was a time that everyone knew him. In his day, he was much more popular than Heschel in terms of influence. Now, who remembers Lieberman? Who remembers Finkelstein? Everyone knows Heschel. But that's because the seminary and conservative Judaism has moved away from this, you know, the focus on Talmud at the seminary. That's Heschel. But in Heschel's lifetime, he was so marginalized. It's a great example of Achrei Mos Kadoshim to you. Heschel was marginalized, completely pushed aside in favor of the Litvox, the Talmud department. But now, of course, and they thought Heschel was crazy, going off, you know, marching with Martin Luther King. But today, people look at Heschel and they see it brings great pride that here he was doing all these wonderful things for civil rights, and his books on the Shabbos and the prophets. They're great stuff. Anyone could benefit from them. But that was not the case during when Lieberman was there. And it was academic study of Judaism. Now, of course, with Neo-Hasidut and everything like that, Heschel's very appealing. But even Finkelstein, they didn't have much patience for anything other than academic studies. Did Lieberman have any children? No, he had no children. Nussan Kamenetsky writes in his book Making of a Gadol, that explains why Lieberman could make unconventional choices with his life, because he didn't have children. He didn't have to marry them off. He wouldn't have to explain, you know, why is he teaching in the seminary? At the same time, he'd be sending his kids to one of the yeshiva gadolas. You know, he didn't have to make those choices because he didn't have children. So that's, and I think that's a very interesting insight from Nussan Kamenetsky. He says the same insight about Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg and also about the Chazon Ish, that these three figures didn't have children, so they were able to make choices that would be unconventional. Yes, obviously the Roman Catholics don't confess straight to God. They confess through a priest. Correct. Baruch says the Navarrete stories might be rare or apocryphal. The one about might be apocryphal about the nails. However, if you read, for example, Moshe Silberg's memoir and others, you see that Navardik was Shiflos Adam. It was, and you have to, the best article is on David Fishman. You see that they cultivated a very different sense, a psychological sense. And privately, someone emails me about Gadolim who worked Tefillin B'chol HaMoed. So you mentioned Rav Yisrael Meltzer. He did. Rav Yisrael Meltzer, but privately, not publicly. Baruch says, Gemara doesn't say that dirty shirt is chayav misa. It talks about a specific type of stain on garment, not any dirt. Listen, Baruch, it's a kasha on a misa. The story is that they're asked, why do you have a stain on your garment when Rama says, Yachayev Misa? And in the story, they don't reply because the Gemara is referring to a different type of garment. The story is that they reply because our entire garment is dirty. Now, did this story ever happen? I don't know, but it's not important. It's the fact that we tell these stories is what shows what people were thinking about them. M.S. Frankel says the president of Breuer's or Breuer's grandson and the rest of the didn't wear kippah at work. Yeah, that's Aaron Bart, famous Aaron Bart, who wrote an important work, a very nice work, Judaism Faces Eternal Problems. It was in Hebrew, translated to English. An old-time German Orthodox Jew, the son of Yaakov Barth, professor at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, great biblical scholar. He was the president of the Bank of Israel. He did not wear a yarmulke. Every picture of him, you don't see a yarmulke. Someone told me a great story that he was at some banking convention somewhere, and all of a sudden he hears thunder. And he takes his yarmulke out of his pocket, puts it on his head, makes the bracha, and puts it back in. And that's German Orthodoxy was interesting. They didn't wear a yarmulke in the schools, in the Jewish schools. We spoke about this. We know this. Someone privately emails me that in the Six-Day War, the New York Times ran a front-page story that referred to a professor who gave $25,000, his life savings. Yeah, it's a famous story. Lieberman didn't deny it was he, but he was insulted that this contribution was described as his entire life savings. And we know that he had a lot more money. He was given a very nice salary. He must have invested it very well because at his passing, the executor of his estate was Dov Zlotnick. And he left a good amount of money to Chabad, which I don't know if he had any real relations other than sending his books to the Rebbe. I don't know what else. Okay, someone privately says that Unterberg is the base medrash, but the picture I'm going to show you, wait till we see the picture when we get to dealing with the seminary, because the room I'm going to show you was much bigger. How was the Chazon Ish unconventional? That was the question I had on Kamenetsky. I think what Kamenetsky means is not in the way that Lieberman or Weinberg were, but for instance, his rejection of the analytic method, which I wouldn't say it's unconventional, his opposition to Musser, you know, making choices that go against the grain of the yeshiva world, I guess. Maybe that's what he had in mind. Okay, I'll say one more thing before we end. Oh, do we have correspondence from the Lubavitch Rebbe to Lieberman? I think you just have like a letter thanking him for his... for sending him things, but we didn't see that, and we'll get back to it later on, that the Rebbe told, and there's a video of it where the Rebbe is speaking about Lieberman. When Zlotnick goes to the Lubavitch Rebbe, I'll show you the video. I showed it to you last semester. But the reason Dimitrovsky, like I said last class, remained at the seminary is because the Rebbe told him as long as Lieberman is there. I'll just end with... one final comment, because someone mentions that Zlotnick had a good relationship with Rebbe. No, actually, let's hold off on this, because when I want to deal with the seminary in America. Lieberman, to a certain extent, is the one giving it legitimacy. So all these people, the old joke about the seminary was, it's Orthodox professors teaching conservative rabbis to minister to Reform laity. The whole Talmud department is really, I mean, is in the shadow of Lieberman, and we'll see how he tries to build it up. Okay, I've spoken long enough. Thank you all. Rabbi Kelman couldn't be with us tonight because he has a different engagement. So I will just then say good night to everyone. Thank you all for coming, and God willing, we'll see you all next week.